Well, hey there. It's Tuesday, November 17th, and you're tuned in to Argus News Radio. News, culture, and life at Wesleyan University and beyond. I'm your host, Andrea Dominic. Hey, thanks so much for tuning in. Argus News Radio is a collaboration between WESU-FM in Middletown and Wesleyan student newspaper, The Argus. As always, let's kick off this week's show with a look at some of the past week's headlines. Just last week, the university announced that it had received approval from the Connecticut Department of Public Health to extend the H1N1 vaccine to high-risk students between the ages of 17 and 24. Previously, only high-risk students 18 years of age and younger were eligible for the vaccine, which excluded most of the campus population. The Davison Health Center hosted two H1N1 flu clinics on November 5th and 6th, and 96 students have been vaccinated thus far. Although the H1N1 vaccine is being provided by the federal government at no cost, it is in short supply. According to the American College Health Association, or ACHA, only 43% of 274 participating institutions reported having had the H1N1 vaccine on hand. The university received its first 100 doses of the H1N1 vaccine last month and was recently allotted an additional 200 doses. According to Joyce Walter, director of the Davison Health Center, the university could be asked to return any unused doses, which would then be redistributed to other campuses and clinics in Connecticut. In Middletown news, on Monday, November 2nd, members of the volunteer organization Food Not Bombs attended a small ceremony at the Buttonwood Tree Cultural Center to receive a check for a $2,000 grant from the Liberty Bank Foundation. After months of fighting to be able to continue sharing their food to Middletown's hungry, Food Not Bombs member Eric Sherman said that the grant showed the changing attitude of the Middletown community. He said, "It's great when some groups recognize that Food Not Bombs is a good thing. It's funny because basically we're doing the exact same thing that we were doing last year. But now in terms of the surrounding climate and awareness, people in Middletown are with it." Sherman believes that the recent public interest in Food Not Bombs derives from the legal battle between the group and the Middletown Health Department over a cease and desist order issued last March. Last month, Connecticut law was amended to allow groups such as Food Not Bombs to share food cooked in private kitchens with the public. Now, that was a look at the past week's headlines, but how about some headlines from the past? Last Friday, the Argus published its annual archives issue, featuring articles from the 1800s to just a few years ago. This issue's theme was disaster of all kinds. Let's take a look at one article from Friday, October 23rd, 1959, by Ed McClellan and Bob Bailey. It's called "Connecticut College Girls Get the Whistles, Holyoke the Dates, but Wellesley Chicks Get the Men." With its usual interest in the cause of public enlightenment, the Argus recently offered Westmen the opportunity to pass judgment on girls from five of the major New England colleges. The young lovelies were assessed via questionnaires on their looks, personality, intelligence, and desirability by 200 coldly calculating Wesleyan students. Connecticut College, Mount Holyoke, Smith, Vassar, and Wellesley were the institutions evaluated in the survey. Conn College was judged to have the most attractive collective countenance, with Wellesley trailing only one vote behind. Mount Holyoke won the personality contest by a large margin, but Wellesley bounced back strongly to take the intelligence honors, with Smith following closely behind. Conn College rejoined the race on the blind date rating, taking top honors away from Wellesley, with 50 Westmen willing to trust their one-night destinies to the New London sweeties. On the crucial test of choice of wife, however, Wellesley triumphed, with Conn and Holyoke tied close behind. The results are by no means conclusive in any of the categories, as the statistics show that the results were usually fairly well spread out. Contradicting the maxim that proximity breeds contempt, Westmen were fairly lavish with praise for Conn College. The maidens from the lower reaches of the Thames River were cited as being warm, easy to snow, doubly well-rounded, and curvaceous. However, some of the more critical observers remarked that they were a mass of wholesome mediocrity, frustrated, and absolutely weird. The South Hadley lasses were depicted as wife and mother types, jolly, mature, wholesome, over-sufficiency of body, unpretentious, and even like-my-sister types. Uncharitably, they were referred to as urbanized milkmaidens and Girl Scouts and hockey players. Vassar suffered heavily from distance and a general lack of knowledge in the poll. Some comments were, "What's Vassar? Does the stage still go that far west?" The blue stocking set, stuffy, doting mama types, and usually fond of buying ice cream cones in a blizzard. On the other hand, they were also credited with being good party girls, progressive, and the greatest girls anywhere. Amherst received a few write-in ballots, but was rated poor on personality. My God, can you believe that that was a real article published in the Argus? I mean, it's ridiculous. Obviously, it's Wesleyan that has the greatest girls anywhere. Rounding out this week's show, as always, is our senior thesis spotlight. Now, when you think about religion, you think about prayer, you think about the afterlife, but what about the afterlife in the living life? A&R contributor Ezra Silk talked to senior Nick Marshall for this week's senior thesis spotlight about his religion thesis on zombies.
Hi, this is Ezra Silk. I'm here with Nick Marshall. He's a senior religion major. He's doing a senior thesis this year on charismatic Christianity. It's a new religious movement that believes in demons. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Nick?
Yeah, charismatic Christianity developed in the past 30 years out of Pentecostalism, which was a major denomination in the mid-century but has sort of taken a back seat to charismatic Christianity. It's really prevalent in the global south, particularly in South America and Africa, and also Sweden, the Netherlands, and the United States. So it's really a global movement. It's very much concerned with the Holy Spirit and Jesus' ministry, and it's not in it. It's notable in that it doesn't necessarily obey denominational boundaries, which means that you can have charismatic Lutherans or charismatic Catholics. It's more of a genre of worship rather than a specific branch of Christianity. So that's maybe the best way to talk about charismatic Christianity.
And is charismatic Christianity making traditional institutions like the Catholic Church nervous?
A little bit, because one of the main sources of charismatic Christian practice in South America and Africa has been drawn from Catholic churches. So charismatic Christianity does something for the people of South America and Africa and the United States and globally, I guess, for people that a lot of traditional institutions isn't really doing. So there's a lot of significance to this fact, and there are currently 800 million charismatic Christians in the world is probably the best indicator out of 2.6 billion total Christians. So it's a huge or significant chunk. I think I read a number saying 35% or 30%, somewhere in that range, but a very, very significant fraction of modern Christians.
Can you describe these people's worldview and how it relates to demons?
First off, what I'm doing is I'm studying a very specific movement within charismatic Christianity called the spiritual warfare movement, which tends to remap the planet in terms of a demonic war between Satan and God, and to interpret world events and to interpret their daily lives in terms of this conflict. So what's really significant about this is that it tends to replace demons and demonic activity and fighting demonic activity at the very center of the way these people experience their lives. So which makes charismatic Christianity and the deliverance ministry, which is the branch of spiritual warfare that talks about fighting demons actively on an individual level, it makes it very, very relevant for the people who are involved in this practice. It makes it basically a tangible vehicle for their salvation by replacing demons within their own bodies. It's really interesting.
And this emerges out of Pentecostalism, which is the snake charmer movement?
Yeah, it's the snake charmer, faith healer, hearing voices, speaking in tongues movement. And all that's really... is really interesting because they're sort of non-normative Christian practices that have nevertheless found a great deal of support and strength in a lot of communities worldwide. And now with the advent of charismatic Christianity, these sorts of practices are moving outside of the Pentecostal church and, as I said previously, moving into more mainline denominations. And it's really interesting.
And you're looking at how this relates to traditional American religious ideologies, which don't usually have a lot to do with spirits and demons, right?
What I'm trying to explain is how these demons live, because they're real beings. They're not imagined as allegorical or metaphorical or figures of literature. They're imagined as actual presences within the people. I'm trying to figure out how these demons are understood to work and live within American culture, and how that working and living contributes to a rearticulation of what it sort of means to be an American in 2009. I'm treating demons and this discourse as a site for a radically different view of what the modern world is and represents. And by doing that, I want to sort of explain the construction of a worldview that lets demons live as it is and yet remains completely modern.
So there's 800 million followers of this movement. What are the implications for a new modern worldview of this demonology?
Well, like, one of the products of the Enlightenment was a very, very critical eye that was cast towards the miracles and signs and wonders in the Bible, and the extension of that into things like unicorns and demons and dragons and centaurs, like magical creatures, or what were then termed magical creatures, but had previously been thought to be real creatures and to be actual physical presences in the world. A lot of that was taken as false or just not accurate, or misreadings or stupidity. And it's something that we thought we've moved past. And demons and the demonic and those sort of presences have moved into the realm of pop culture. We have Buffy the Vampire Slayer is obsessed with demons, but it's not in a real sense. It's not in an actual lived sense. So what I'm looking at demons as is they're almost this curious cultural survival, in that they're a figure that we thought we don't think demons are real, but there are people who might be at the supermarket next door to us who look at me talking to my girlfriend and see bickering as the product of demons of resentment inhabiting each of our bodies. Right. And that's really weird, and that's really interesting, and it's really prevalent. So it's not just this minor or insubstantial belief. It's this big, huge movement that can think of demons as real creatures, and it lives, and this movement lives and works in the modern American United States. And that's really, it's just really interesting.
Well, I gotta say, I didn't know about charismatic Christianity as of 5 minutes ago, but I'm a little scared now. but thanks for coming in, Nick.
It's not that scary.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Argus News Radio. Our fabulous staff are producers Mary Longley and Sam Bernhardt, senior contributor Ezra Silk, and me, your host, Andrea Dominic. Be sure to catch us next week, same Argus time and same Argus place, 2:45 p.m. on Tuesdays, right here on WESU-FM in Middletown. Or you can catch us online, anytime, streaming on the Argus' website. That's www.wesleyanargus.com. Signing off, this is Argus News Radio.